the entertainment capital of the world, of Las Vegas, Nevada, it's Midnight in the Marshaverse, starring Marsha Warfield and her two sons, Stephen Roberts and Gil Hudson, as the problem child.
Well, good evening. Welcome to Midnight in the Marshaverse, where night owls get together to relax and chill, get a little mellow, take the edge off of the day. Some of us like to have a little cannabis and cognac once a week just to chill. And so we're going to have that here tonight. This is Shannon Shades, Shannon Sharp's Shea. And it's some expensive ass shit. Over there, I have a bottle of Fitties Cognac Branson that we'll have next week. And it's about half the price of this. And I think they're both VSOPs. So we'll see. We'll check the quality and see if there's any special reason that this is priced the way it is besides the lovely bottle. Anyway, we also have... Well, maybe that's why it costs so much. The good stopper. Okay, that's all we need. Now, cannabis. Because, you know, old people, we've been smoking reefer. They was calling it smoking reefer. So, this is a Church Battery, one of my favorites. And it's a Camp cartridge, Camp Live Resin cartridge. So we're going to try this out, see what it's about. That's all I need. And here's to you. Not bad. Okay. So now that we have that out of the way, tonight we're going to talk about some things that are near and dear to my heart that I don't think get enough attention from the perspective of people who are actually there. And I'm going to talk about it with an old friend of mine that I've known and loved since we were both children. It was long, long ago, and we'll get into all of that a little later. But I hear tonight the DNC was rocking. I heard there was all kind of parties going on, all kind of playing the dozens. It was just like it was a cookout. I didn't get to see it because I was at work. I was at the Comedy Cellar, two shows tonight, all through the week. I'll be there till Sunday. And at the Rio here in Las Vegas. But I hear it was fun. Now, we are here at Midnight the Marshaverse strongly support Kamala Harris. We have supported her through everything. And we believe that she needs a strong campaign song. And so we have written, so my sons have written, and we're going to later play the two finalist songs in the competition and give you a chance to vote. And choose the one you think that the campaign should use. But before we do all of that, I want to talk about something that happened at the DNC. Lil Jon was there. And he said, what did he say? Fire up the loud. At the DNC, have we entered a new era or what, where adults can make adult decisions and talk about things in a whole different way, where we accept things that some people enjoy and not with others, but we get together and have a party. You have party favors. I want to talk about our sponsor. I think we should get right into our sponsor. Of course, I'm talking about Aunt Karen. Aunt Karen's Southern Suburban Seasoning Spam and Lima Bean Succotash Casserole in a can. Here at Aunt Karen's Suburban Seasonings, we know that after a long day of harassing strangers who happen to wander into your neighborhood, you just don't have time to put together a nutritious, if not delicious, meal for your family. So, we do it for you. Each can of quick-cooking, overly processed, GMO-laden, bioengineered foodstuffs we make is designed with you in mind. Just boil vigorously right in the can. When all the water is evaporated, slide the gooey gelatinous masterpiece onto a platter, slice, and proudly serve this healthy, gluten-free concoction to your family. Just add ketchup and serve with reconstituted powdered milk for a meal no American family will ever forget or tire of. And remember, Aunt Karen's meals never spoil, so they're great rations for laying in your bunker. Stock up now before your starving children call CBS on you. So, thank you, Aunt Karen, for your wonderful sponsorship. And we can move on now to our next segment. So while I've been watching the campaign take shape, I've noticed that there have been a lot of different groups coming out in support of Kamala Harris and raising money. And I think we should have our own group, Old Potheads for Kamala. And I think we should all get together and donate 420, any combination of 420, so that we can give the money to the campaign, so we can legalize this across the country, a federal bill, and hope that we can have our seat at the table. I'd like to introduce an old friend of mine who, man, 1974, 75, I met this man. And he has the most remarkable journey of a comedian ever. We can talk about that in a minute. But I'm so happy that we can get together and talk and not just catch up on old times, but tell the truth about some pretty important comedy history that doesn't usually get spoken about from the point of view of people who were there and know what the hell they're talking about. So, if you will you please welcome my good friend, Dr. Bill Miller. Hi, Bill.
Thank you. How you doing, Marcia? Thank you very much for having me.
Well, thank you for coming on this late at night. I know you're in Chicago and it's like 2-3 in the morning, and I appreciate you being here.
No, that's okay. Listen, we go back way back, and if you said, Billy, I want you to be here, I'm there. It doesn't matter what time, it doesn't matter where, I'm there. I'm there for you.
We go
back long way. Neither of us needed these.
Okay. But you always were there for me. I would travel from the South Side on the bus, on the L, on another bus, and for hours to get there and be perfectly ready to take that same trip home. But you never let me do that. You put me in your car, and you didn't have to go to the South Side. And you'd take me home, and then we'd sit outside and talk and talk and talk until my dog came along and said, go in the house, and we'd still talk some more. So I appreciate that about you. So you were in med school.
I was in Chicago. I was in med school. That's when I started doing comedy.
Wait a minute. And that doesn't really make sense, okay? Explain to people how that came about in your life.
You know, I always wanted to be a comedian. My parents kind of pushed me into medicine, you know, and I remember going to the comedy store before I started medical school every night in the summer. And I met Spoon and a bunch of other guys who were down there at the time. And I thought, I want to do this. So I went to medical school in Chicago. I used to live in LA And the first Christmas vacation back, I said, I'm going up to this, the newcomer night is what they called it back then, the Monday night at the Comedy Store. You know, I waited in line. I had my 5 minutes. I wrote jokes and I went on stage and I did my 5 minutes. I was scared to death. I was shaking inside. I was just shaking. And I got laughs. Well, you know how it is. Then it's like, oh, I'm hooked, man. That's it. I bit the hook. The hook's in there a lot. So when I came back to Chicago after the Christmas vacation, I heard that there was some open mics that comedians, I read an article in the Reader, and I went to the Kingston Mines, and that's where I met you and Brent Jordan, RIP, and Brad Sanders, and Tom Dreesen, O'Brien Severa, and Daryl Bohannon, and Jimmy Alec, and a bunch, you know, a bunch of comedians. Jay Leslie Jackson, right?
Orlando
Ray, rest in peace. And then we went to some bunch of clubs. Anywhere we could get on, we went on. I mean, anywhere. And I went to clubs way down on the south side where the guys from the Chitlin' Circuit, Pretty Bob and something red that would say, put it in a bucket and fuck it. I forget his name.
Well, there was Mr. B, and I can't remember the and
Mr. Lonnie B.
And I think it was Lonnie who said, put it in a bucket and fuck it.
Yeah, it could have been Lonnie Franklin. Anyway, so I kept on working anywhere I could work, and I kept doing both. You know, that first year when I was going every showcase every night that I could find, I almost flunked out of school. But, you know.
Say, how did you keep your studies up and going to clubs all the time doing stand-up?
Well, the first year was a little tough, and then I realized, you know, hey, I got to do something here. Northwestern was all pass-fail. So the last couple of weeks, I laid off the showcases and just crammed and did, like, my most monumental cramming, and I got through that first year. And then the second year and the third year and the fourth year, I kind of did a better schedule so I could handle both. And then graduated, went back to – did an internship at L.A. County, so I was out in the L.A. area. And that's when, you know, I was working some spots at the Comedy Store doing, you know, and before I come home every summer, I was working Westwood and the Sunset Store and going back and forth. And the last couple of years I was in Chicago because they needed all the rotations. So I hadn't been back in a while. And then when I came back, I started back to it. And that's when it happened, when I was an intern.
That's amazing. And I mean, that's a book in and of itself. But in between some of those times you were mentioning, there was an event that I think made changed the direction of comedy, period, in this country. There was a Comedy Store strike because nobody was getting paid. This was 1979. The Comedy Store had opened like in 72, 73, and the Improv had moved out 73, 74, and nobody was getting paid. But Mitzi was making a lot of money, and they were opening all these clubs. Mitzi bought the whole building. She didn't own it in the beginning. She only owned a little.
Right.
She bought the whole building. She bought property in the most expensive real estate in Los Angeles, then in San Diego, in La Jolla, and condos and stuff, and the comics weren't getting paid. So we went on strike.
I remember that.
I know you were like...
I was one of the guys.
Neck deep in the organization of it. How do you?
I was one of the guys. Well, I remember they had a big meeting at the Comedy Store main room. A lot of the comedians, that's when they asked Mitzi, I guess, for money. And she said no. And then she looked at a few people. And I remember her saying, you know, some of you don't deserve it. You know, we're giving you a place to work out, that type of stuff. And then the comics went on strike and we wanted to form a union. And I was one of the founding members along with Joanne Astro, Jay Lett, I think it was. Well, first, let me back up. David Letterman's lawyer, one of the articles that you had sent me, they had Mark Lenow as the lawyer.
Right.
And that was totally wrong. Mark Lenow was Joanne Astro's husband and part owner of the Improv.
Right.
The lawyer that was involved was Dave Letterman's lawyer, a guy named Ken Browning. So we were all sitting at the table negotiating with Bud, you know, because I think at that time the strike was ongoing. We were picketing in front of the comedy store. Guys like Leno came on the picket line. Letterman, there was a bunch of comedians carrying signs. I don't know if George Miller was on the line, but I know that Dreesen was there, and there were a couple other guys. I remember one guy who was like an acrobatic comedian from Venezuela. He had a tennis racket, and then he had a sign below it saying, "Mixie has a great racket."
Masada?
What's that? I remember Jamie Masada, but he was down the block. He opened up the Laugh Factory in a little corner.
It wasn't open yet. He was hanging around the strike, saying, "I'll pay you guys. I'm going to open a club. I'm going to open a club and pay you guys because you deserve to be paid." And so he was hanging around with us during the strike.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then it's funny, though, because when he first got his club, he didn't pay anybody.
I have worked there, but I never.
Oh, I went there in the beginning a lot of times, you know. Yeah, and I'm happy, you know, to know him. I worked at Laugh Factory here in Chicago, but, you know, that's another story. So
Bud signed off from the beginning. Soon as we
Bud signed on, right.
So brought the proposal to him. He signed
up. So
we'll match whatever you get.
We were having discussions with Bud, and I remember sitting at the table, and I'll never forget it. It was Letterman, Tom Dreesen, Letterman's attorney, Joanne Astro, me. It could have been Ellis Levinson. There was a couple other people there. And they're talking about Bud. We're asking for, you know, some kind of money. I forget what the money was. And Bud's going, "Oh, you know, I can't do that. I'll show you the books." And then I said to Bud, "Bud, I'm Jewish too. Show us the real set of books." And everyone at the table started laughing. And then they came up with either that day or the next session. He came up with like $25 a set, or $15 a set. It was basically gas money, and you could buy a hamburger or something. But you know, it was something.
We could eat.
it was something, especially when you looked up at the line outside the comedy store. In the beginning, and there were some people there that were. They were getting screams, breaking the room apart, standing O's, you know, talented people. Okay. They're well beyond their, "I got to work out to get a routine. You know, I need to try out some stuff." They were well beyond that. People would line up, you know, I'm not going to mention the names of the store, but you know, if so-and-so was working that night, oh God, the line got longer and longer and longer. You know, I mean, you'd be at the store and Freddie Prinze would pop in. You know, these are guys who don't need a place to work out.
Right.
You know? And then they were we wanted to form a union, the comedians. So I was involved. I was one of the charter members of the American Federation of Comedians.
Yeah.
And and it was and Joanne Astro was like the president, and
Elaine Boozler was very involved.
Who?
Elaine Boozler.
Oh yeah, Boozer was very involved. We had meetings at her house and Joanne Astro's house and a bunch of different places. and then the comedian, a lot of other clubs, where the strike was going on, a lot of other clubs wanted to cash in on that. So they were saying, We'll pay you, So a couple of us from the AFC, myself, Brent Jordan, and I think somebody else started booking. There were a place in Century City. There was a place in Santa Monica, way down on Wilshire Boulevard somewhere. And there was another place in the valley, a little delicatessen that had a back room in the back. So he put a comedy in there called the Deli Smoker. And they would pay guys, you know, a few bucks.
Sure.
So they were going around town. So we were one of the bookers, and we had to, you know, people wanted to work here or there. We'd have to figure out the timing. So they go down to Santa Monica, be there at 8:30 or 9 o'clock, and come over to here at 10 and go over there at 12. So by driving all around, you got gas money and you got a little money to eat.
Right, right.
You know?
But then at the same time, they were starting these franchise clubs where the old clubs started franchising the Improv, the Comedy Store, Laugh Stop in Newport Beach. And so you could work all around.
These comedy club.
And they paid, you know, the three-act structure, comedy, a headliner, middle act, and a host.
Right.
And you could make rent. You could make a living. You started to make, have a circuit now that also needed talent, needed more talent than was out there. So it started grooming talent and bringing talent into the game so that there was so many opportunities for so many people to become comedians. And it was almost as a direct result of that strike that we became this booming industry. Now, you have to consider, too, and I was talking about this early, cable was starting and starting to grow. The Tonight Show had moved to Los Angeles.
Burbank, yeah.
The marketing, because from New York to Los Angeles, everything moved west. There were a lot of things that came together in a confluence of events that allowed comedy to boom in the 80s. But I think one of the biggest catalysts that's jumping off was when comedians started getting paid.
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right.
So now what are you doing? You've retired as a doctor.
As a doctor. I'm still doing comedy.
As a doctor, you've retired. You've got that done. Now, your dream, how's it going?
It's going okay. I'm working at clubs. I just got through with a headlining gig at CG's Comedy Club out in the suburb of Chicago. I'm headlining Zany's Rosemont March 2nd.
Okay.
I got a lot of showcases and other kind of hospital gigs is what I'm pursuing now. Doing a lot of corporate events, which, as you know, we did one, a Zoom show that you graced us with. Yeah.
Yeah,
that was fine. And I'm doing that, so I'm keeping busy. And now that I'm not working as a doctor, I have a lot more time to pursue this.
Do that
full time. Yeah, it's great. You know how it is. You know, you get in front of an audience, and what comes in your head goes out of your mouth and into their ears, and then they laugh. I mean, that's like, there's nothing better.
Yeah.
At that moment in time, there is nothing better than what started here, came out of here, went into their ears, and you see them laugh. Nothing better.
You know,
doesn't
that's
matter.
The biggest miracle in the world to me, that you can think a thought and share it with somebody else. And then share it with thousands of people, millions of people.
Yeah.
Somebody's thoughts are in books and libraries from thousands of years ago. I mean, it's the ability to communicate and then to be able to hold an audience and make them laugh. There's no greater blessing.
Nothing better.
It's the most wonderful thing. I could talk to you all night. You know that, right?
Yeah, yes, I do. And we have in the past, and I had to go back to medical school, and the sun started to come up, and those birds start chirping, which pissed me off, because then I know, shit, it's morning, and I've been up all night, but I know you got other guests.
No, we just we learned so much, and I know they would love to talk to you, because they've seen you and met you before, right? You've met both the skills. But I think they both have questions. So if you can sit there a minute, maybe we can bring them out and have you say a little something to them.
It'd be my pleasure.
Okay. Well, then I'd like to introduce my two sons. My two sons. Da, 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 da. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome my oldest son, the one that looks most like me, Stephen Roberts. Hi.
Hi, Mom.
Hi, honey.
And hi, Dr. Bill.
His brother.
Hi, how you doing, Stephen?
My adorable problem child, Skills Hudson.
Hey, what up, Tomo? What up, yeah. Dr. Bill? This is my first time meeting him, though. This is my first time. It's a pleasure, man.
Yeah, my pleasure. All mine.
Born and raised. So, you guys, you have any questions, anything you heard that or thought about or heard about the strike? You want to ask him or anything?
Yeah, I would like to ask Dr. Bill, what was Marsha like back in 1979? What did she look like? What was it like to be her friend? I'd like to know everything you could tell me about Marsha in 1979.
Marsha in 1979 was amazing. She was gorgeous, funny, loyal, dedicated, and would give you the clothes off her back if she liked you and you were in need. Period. And she was the most giving of her talent and knowledge to all the other comedians. And we, you know, we did a show one time at the Kingston Mines when it was not where it is now, if you're in Chicago. It was on Lincoln Avenue upstairs, you know. They had a room upstairs, which is basically it.
We cleaned it out. So we took shows up there.
It was an attic. It was a storage room for that chairs and shit.
Rasso's, we did both of those clubs. We cleaned both of them out.
Yeah, and there was, we said that they did, not, that was right before I got, that was one of my first shows. And they said, give us a waitress, send her upstairs, put some chairs there, we'll do comedy show. So all of a sudden, so we're up there, and one of the first times I met Marsha, there was two people sitting in these chairs side by side, and we're doing a show. There's like six comedians. It was me, Brent Jordan, Marsha Warfield. And every one of them went up, and those people, God bless them. It was a godsend, I'm sure, because it would have discouraged everybody if we're there all night in front of two people who didn't chuckle. They laughed at every goddamn joke out of every comedian's mouth, whether it was funny or not. And I remember, you know, we're all talking and talk to the crowd, the two people in the audience. They left, and then we used to all hang around and philosophize about comedy, because we were all into Lenny Bruce, and we were thinking of Richard Pryor, and I had read books, and Marsha had read comedy books, and we're all talking, and that's what Marsha was. We would sit around until all hours of the morning after any show anywhere in the city, any showcase place, and just talk. We would smoke a little, but we would.
Comedian.
And she was, she still is beautiful. She was knocked down gorgeous. That's what I'm telling you. And I remember Brent and I, we got a room for a Sunday night at the steakhouse, some kind of steak, the Red Garter Steakhouse. Do you remember that?
Barely.
And Brent and I had we went and talked to the owner and said, we're going to have comedy here, because everybody wanted comedy. It's starting to blow up. And Marsha was going to be the first headline. So Marsha, this is like a nice gig. She came dressed up, knockout gorgeous. But her heart is the biggest, the most beautiful thing about her.
That's sweet.
Always was, always will be, I think.
Very sweet, man. And thank you so much for that. And I'll pay you later. Anyway, Skill, no. What you got for Dr. Bill?
Well, that kind of answered my question a little bit. I was going to ask about one of y'all's smallest shows together and one of y'all biggest shows together. But before I say that, I wanted to just shout both of y'all out, man. Thank y'all for, you know, being some of the pioneers and paving that way. I remember doing like 11 years in L.A. and hearing this about like the strike. I remember being so happy to get the $15, $20, and to know the origin of where that came from, you know what I'm saying? You know, when I would get that check for $20, $25 from the Laugh Factory, or get the $10 or $15 from the Comedy Store, and knowing that it was comics that stood up to, you know, and we still at times had to go through it at other shows, but to know the origin of that, it was, man, it was great to hear.
We didn't know not to. You know, we were too stupid not to try stuff. We were too young. We were so young and just, you know, righteous. And I've said that I think all judges should be under 12 years old, because the younger you are, the more you know about fairness. And so as young as we were, we still understood what was fair and what wasn't. We didn't know what was legal. We didn't know what was possible, but we knew what was fair. And so we didn't have the sense to be scared. And we just, this is the problem. We got to do it. So luckily it worked out, and it's still reaping benefits for people. And hopefully, if nothing else, it gave them or will continue to give them the courage to stand up. Stand up really means stand up. And so you stand up in your, in yourself, in your politics, in your everything in your life. And so thank y'all. If you have any, you want to answer skills?
No, I want to say so. You know, it would have been one thing if, you know, you went over to the Comedy Store or any other facility, any other club that would say, okay, we're going to have a showcase that. And you look around and there's empty tables and the people just coming in like a normal thing. And they try, you know, that'd be one thing. Okay. So I understand you run a business, you're giving us a stage. But when people were lining up down the block and then they were having two shows a night, okay, turning the house.
Yeah. In more than one club.
Right. You know, but this was one club in the beginning. But and then you start saying, wait a minute now. I mean, I know you're giving us a chance to work our hone our craft, but our craft, even in the workout stage and in the rough end stage, is still good enough where people want to pay to hear Marshall Warfield or
Robin Williams,
a bunch of Robin Williams, Bruce Baum, Charlie Fleischer, Tim Thomerson, Biff Maynard, you know, a bunch of people. If they're good enough.
Shirley Hemphill had a show.
Right.
I mean.
Right.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you're talking about that. I'm glad you're talking about that, Bill, because I don't think people understand how hot and how new this whole art was back then and how it had exploded and that it was the thing. And so many TV shows and specials on new channels like HBO were featuring people like George Carlin. Everybody wanted a piece of or to get to see stand-up comedy. And I would like to encourage anybody who...
You got to credit really, Saturday Night Live.
And Saturday Night Live. But I would like to tell anybody out there who finds this story fascinating or would like to really know the history to read that book I'm Dying Up Here, because it is such a good history of what happened at the Comedy Store. And nothing gives me more pleasure than to be reading that book and then see my comedy mom in there being quoted and saying what she did and what her voice in the conversation is amazing. So I encourage anybody to read that book. It's such a good book.
The clubs in New York took a lead. They saw what went on in California and they said, we're not doing that. So they started paying the clubs in New York. So now to this day, there's a lot of clubs in New York, a lot of more people crammed in, you know, Manhattan, but there's friends of mine who are in New York who can do four shows a night.
Right.
Who on the weekend can go around and literally, you know, between the clubs, if you're good, they're going to go around and they're going to hire you and you can make a living and pay your rent and have groceries on the table. You're not going to buy a car, but you're going to be able to afford to get to that gig to entertain the people as well as working on your craft. It's not like the grand big audience, you know, like when you headline your own show, you get a door deal, you know, that's when you make your money, but at least you're not being exploited.
Right.
You know, to the point, you know, especially when people are lining up to get in those clubs. So,
right. So thank you, Bill, for coming on the show. You're welcome here anytime. And we want to know where you are, when you are, so people can come out and support you all the time.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure.
And
if you ever need me, I'm there.
All right.
And before you go, Bill, before you go, Dr. Bill, I wanted to show you something on my elbow. No, I'm just kidding.
I'm sure you do. Hey, you got insurance? You know, I'm retired now, but I still take cash. All right. Hey, I'll look what you got to pay. You got to pay. But
still about getting paid.
All right.
Thanks for staying up.
Good night.
I keep seeing online these men saying, asking women, would you serve your husband first or your kid or at all? And they believe that women should serve them first and then their children and eat last. And it makes me so mad because who the fuck, why would anybody serve you at all? Just be, well, I'm the head of the household. Yeah, who gives a shit? Why would your hands ain't broke? How come you're not serving your wife? Your wife is the one had the babies. They want to say, well, I'm paying the bills. I'm doing this, that, I'm doing that. Your wife had the children. You can't do anything that compares to us shooting a human being out your twat. You just can't. And you can't. There's not enough money to equal that. So you should be serving your wife at every chance you can. And I think the difference between lesbians and straight men is that lesbians actually like women. We actually love women. And so we treat them in a whole different way. We don't expect to be served. I mean, we serve each other. And the notion, the entitlement, the tradition of men just thinking that they can be lord and master over somebody and treat them like a slave, it just makes me so mad that I just have to say, stop it. What makes you so special? You have a penis. Okay, so what? I can make people. It don't really compare.
I like to say I'm over it this summer. Like, I don't want to never see another summer. I really don't. I don't want to. I mean, let me rephrase that. I want to see more summers. I want to be alive, but I would not want to feel another summer. This Saturday is supposed to be 96. It's been over 100 for 59 days. 59 days. They don't supposed to do that in the world, in this world. I don't.
Who's not supposed to do that?
Huh?
Who's that?
They're supposed to do that out of this world, on the moon, Saturn, Pluto. That's where you have these types of heat. Phoenix, this is not where you're supposed to be having this all the time. Look, mind, you know, like when we hear these advertisements, are you ready for 90 days of summer? No, I'm not ready for 90 days. I'm ready for a nice little 19. Can you give me 19, 20? 22 days, you know what I'm saying? Can you dip it down to 89 a couple of times, then pop up 104, 107? Do I have to come back? 115, 119, 122, 116. Is this Keno? What are we doing?
Okay. Well, I feel you, but I want to talk to you when it's like 32 outside. Anyway, that'll be a whole different conversation. Hi.
Hi. Also, I would like to say that what summer are you talking about? Because a summer in Chicago or a summer in Massachusetts is much different than a summer in Las Vegas.
I know. I'll take the humidity.
What kind of summer are you having in Chicago? You're in Chicago right now, right?
Oh, it's so nice.
Is it muggy?
It is not muggy. It is perfect weather right now. Perfect. It's like 77 with the sun out and clear skies and no humidity, but just a lovely, gentle breeze. I was out on the lake shore all day today, just hiking around, and it was like perfect. I was wearing pants.
Ooh, rub it in.
Oh, so nice. Yeah.
So what's your rant, and then we'll get back to this weather discussion.
Okay. You ready for my rant?
No, but do
here
it
we go. Here we go. Why do you need to play your music in your grocery cart when you're shopping? Why is this necessary? Why do you need to bring your JBL remote speaker and put it in your shopping cart while you're at the Walmart? Nobody wants to hear your music. We don't like your music. You don't like our music. We don't like your music. Why do we have to listen to this? Why? What is it about people with the music who think that everybody else wants to hear their music? And how can you be so blind to the fact that your music sucks? I don't like your music. Will you please turn that down? If I were to ask somebody to turn their music down, I would be the asshole. But they're the one who walked into the Circle K with their JBL thing blasting their fucking music. So we're all supposed to put up with that because you want to listen to your music? What the fuck? That's so unfair. That is so... Oh, it's so rude. Oh, my God. Or they take their music into, let's say, the bank, you know, and nobody wants to say anything to them because if you say something to them, then you become the asshole, even yeah. though they're the ones who did it. I just don't understand this kind of selfishness. I really don't.
Well,
okay, I'm done now.
Is caring.
What did you say?
Sharing is caring.
Because I enjoy hearing music. I'll be.
Not all music. If you wouldn't like my music, you would not like my music.
Yes, I would. I would like it for the moment. I wouldn't pull it up. I wouldn't pull it up on my own phone.
But what if there's music inside the place already? So now we don't even get to enjoy anything because we're hearing the clash of the music.
You enjoy music?
I love music.
Music.
Not Muzak. No, I don't like Muzak.
Well, this was inside.
Oh, not always. Not always. Not in the Gap. Not in the Hot Topic.
Set to some kind of auto-tune stuff. It's just, who wants to hear that?
Some music is good in the stores. If you go into the right stores.
I come in, booming James Brown, okay? Automatically, everybody gets uplifted. We're not just going through the motions in the bank. We're like, hey, I don't want nobody to give me nothing. and we can all...
Okay, well, I'll tell you what. If it was James Brown, I wouldn't have as much of a problem. If it was some good music, that would be different. It would be totally different. But you know what? We're in the library. Can you just put that outside for now?
Well, I guess you have a point.
They are absolutely sparked now. The energy is crazy. It is a whole different party right now than it was less than a month ago. It's a whole different game. It's a whole different game.
Is this filling in the streets? Are people in regular everyday situations? Are they talking about it? Are they?
It's at the water cooler now.
It
for
is.
For sure.
Cool.
For sure. I have, especially here in town, I have friends who are here and they're just like, the whole north side is just buzzing. Like everybody's excited. I was standing outside a coffee shop today and a lady with a stack of Harris Walls yard signs, she comes up to me and says, do you have a front lawn? I was like, I don't live here. She goes, oh, I'll give you a small one then.
Okay.
I can't fit it into my suitcase, but I would love to take it. Passing out signs. Cool. I loved it. Yeah.
Skills.
Look, I found it interesting when I was watching today the roll call. And each state they get to verbally say about the delegates that was gonna go to her, and then at the end say their love, like and give it up for the first black each one had a different saying, right? But the first three states, right? They said that give it up for the first black Asian American, and then when that came to, I think it was at Georgia, the lady, she said strongly. She was like, you can give it up for the first black president. I mean, female president. Okay. Right. And then the next 10 states, they said, give it up for the first woman president. Nobody said, like it was in my mind. I'm like, did they pass it on? Like, hey, just give it up for the women. Just let's keep keep it down. And then you got a couple of more random states. They said, you know what I'm saying? But then, you know, Massachusetts, they said, give it up for the, you know, first woman. But I realized that I was laughing to myself when I noticed that.
Well, this is going to be quite the accomplishment. And looking back over my lifetime, and what one of the things I noticed that probably nobody would pay any attention to was the number of women in pants. At a formal event, women in pants is acceptable. For the first part of my life, women could not wear pants in social situations. The state or the amount of freedom that women had to wear pants kind of is a measure of how far women have come. Because when Lucy wore capri pants, and she never had masculine trousers, or even when she did, they were always feminized, and it was a big deal. You know, she had to fight to be able to do that. And when Mary Tyler Moore came along and wore dance pants, and that was a big deal, and you had to fight for that. And when Hillary Clinton first wore pants, pantsuits, it was a big deal. In fact, they ended up naming her coalition Pantsuit Nation because it became the tan suit for women. And to see all of the movers and shakers, the queens of the DNC be able to take the stage looking strong, lovely, competent, ready, in their various clothes, but the number of pants and slack suits, and especially on Kamala Harris, was just, to me, it was something I took notice of and was...
It's like that's the preferred attire. That's the compulsory attire. It's pants. Or if you wear a dress, you're looking weaker now.
Well,
it's the opposite.
I think that that's part of what I was seeing, too, that it didn't matter that there were powerful women. It was just the comfort of the woman, whoever right. she was, and whether she presented a little more masculine or feminine in those traditional things was entirely up to the personality.
Kamala in a dress? I don't think I can remember her in a dress.
I do remember seeing some pictures because I remember saying to myself, ooh, she got some nice legs.
Yeah, oh, okay.
That's you. That sounds like you. But I like to...
Nice calves, too. She got some real nice calves.
Watch it, buddy. Watch it.
Turned up, then she looked like a round-the-way girl, you know. But like I said, it's refreshing to see women in such confident, assertive,
yes,
and still being women, not necessarily masculine, but not weak in any way, and competent. And she seems the far more competent and leader like person compared to her opponent. I'm excited for that, and I'm excited for one of your songs to be included in the campaign. And so we have narrowed it down.
Okay, here we go.
Songs that we want the audience to vote for. Please come to our website and vote for the song that you think should be the Kamala Harris.
Who is the two finalists? Oh, us? Oh, we were the only two contestants.
I knew you'd get it. I knew you. I have faith in you. I knew you'd get it. That's my baby. Anyway, can we play our two final song finalist entries?
Sure.
She is who she is, and who she is a black woman. She is who she is. The Republican Party didn't see it coming. She was the VP and played second fiddle, but she's gonna kick the ass of the guy with the hands that are little. This country won't be worth a piss until we say vote Kamala Harris.
Yay!
Wait, there's more.
There's more.
Okay. Your vote is your vote, and your one vote needs no excuses. You know who is right. She doesn't lie. She's not abusive. There's one office, but two parties who want it. Two candidates, and we know who the real is. This country won't be worth a piss until we say, hey, world, she is Kamala Harris.
That was very, very good. Yeah. Very FDR.
Oh, thank you.
I got a special guest that's going to help me sing the little song. All right, it's kind of camera shy. All right.
Okay.
Y'all ready? One, two, three. Come on. It's her, not Joe. Come on. It's her, not Joe.
Thank you. Turn it around. Does that vibrate?
Turn it around. There we go. Now we can see it.
Does that vibrate?
Hello.
Anyway,
hello. I'm trying to get the angle right.
Now we've seen enough of, he looks, you remember those peanut, orange circus peanuts that they would
bring out
and that nobody liked?
Yes, nobody ate them.
They look like
this is Lil Slump. He's gonna be making little special appearances. This is Lil Slump.
In Cheeto juice. It's just, that looks disgusting.
Lil Slump, man.
I see that.
He's going to be making special appearances. He just wanted to come in. All right, he's gone.
Thank you. That was your entree, whatever.
Entree.
Steven.
Yes.
Thank you for your reading material. I'm so glad you're keeping abreast. I have too. Would you give us a little...
Wait a minute. What did that book say? How... Oh, I ain't gonna even say what I thought then. I just see FA.
I don't need a book for that.
No. Steven.
Yes.
Darling.
Yes.
A little snippet of your.
I don't.
Can I say just this one last thing? You said you don't need a book for that. Maybe you was just refresh.
Your last composition.
Which one? I'm talking about Kamala La 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 La. La.
Yes. So those are our two final entries into the Kamala Walls campaign theme.
Your
song.
Youngest son is cracking himself up a whole lot right now. I don't know if you noticed this.
We would love to buy him more toys. I think that's what we're finding out. He needs something to do with his hands. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, watching the show, Boys, Girls, Moms, Dad. If you like either one of those songs, please vote, and we will reveal the winner next week on next week's show.
Wait a minute, you didn't play the song, did you?
Yes. It's in the magic of television editing.
Oh.
They're going to insert it. Not that you need to know anything about that.
Insert. You know about insert. Anyway.
I'm an inserter.
Of course you are. Here, I want to show you something, Mom.
We've heard that about.
Mom, look what I got while I was in Chicago. Look.
Ooh. That's good. You get some turtles.
You know what I got? I got my favorite candy that you can't get anywhere, even at the airport when they have Fannie Mae. It's Trinidad's.
I don't know what Trinidad's are.
Ooh, I'll show you.
Ooh, white people candy.
No, this is not white people candy. There's no white people candy.
Idiot. Fannie Mae. Black people never bring anything white from Fannie Mae.
What are they? What do you guys get at Fannie Mae? Don't get Fannie Mae?
We get Fannie Mae, but we get chocolate from Fannie Mae.
Hold on. Look.
Ooh.
Is that real Vivid cake in there?
No, it's chocolate. It's pure fudge chocolate inside a little coconut coating.
Yeah, but niggas ain't fucking with that. No, I'm sorry.
House, they'd be like,
you would love this.
You know, we might love it once we ate it, but I'm telling you.
You know what? Brown and white go really well together. Brown
and white. Yeah, it's integration candy. So we get.
That look real bougie.
You would love it.
We get cordials. We get.
We get those too. We get cordials. We get turtles. We get all that too. But this you can't get anywhere except Chicago. And they're
whatchamacallit.
Trinidad.
Whatchamacallit.
Whatchamacallit.
Just bought a box of whatchamacallit. Okay.
I just bought a fancy whatchamacallit. Is that what you're saying?
And that's what he said.
Well, he's wrong because he hasn't tried it.
Guys, we've had this time together in the words of the immortal Carol Burnett, and I'm so glad that we have, and I thank you both, and I thank Dr. Bill for joining us, and I want to talk about my trip to Martha's Vineyard.
Oh.
Yeah.
Was it fancy?
No, it's not really fancy, but it was I like the Tom Joyner Cruise, where you get to see black people with money, you know, with means normalized.
Spending it.
Everybody there. And it's, you know, you guys know my act, so you know how I talk about Upper Ghetto and how the black community was zoned so that all income levels were in proximity. So we don't really have the same kind of class structure that other people do because, you know, the guy next door might be a wealthy businessman and the other house here might be Section 8. I mean, so when you have these kind of gatherings in places where you get to see that there is a black middle class, upper class, people of enough means to summer for a week on Martha's Vineyard and to see that they're, you know, they having the same kind of white parties that they have on the South Side. We have a culture, a shared culture, and it doesn't really matter about those kinds of income levels. We all gonna get together. When they go home, you know, they're going to get together with people in their family who have different kind of jobs. But it's just interesting to me to be in that kind of environment. And I got to hang out with Joe Claire, who's a very funny young man. You know Joe Claire?
I never. Yeah.
You know who he is. He's a
comic.
And he has a show in Washington?
Banging in a buoy or something. Yeah.
Yeah. And so he's another, y'all got another brother. He's another son. We had a very.
Well, we'll be the judges of that.
Yeah.
We don't know these other brothers and nephews.
Hey, I don't think that's how it works. You can't, you don't get.
Yes, we can.
Yes, we can. We're not sharing you with just anybody. Yes, hey.
I would love Joe.
You see how she sneaked that in, too? Yeah, he just said all these accolades.
You just shut up and take it. Anyway.
That is the third time she's told us to shut up tonight, by the way.
B. Cole. Do you know B. Cole?
Yes, Chicago, yeah.
Yes, he was there too, and so good. That was the show I was on. It was a great show. I had a lot of fun with them and had a lot of fun in town. And so I was happy. We took a lot of pictures. And the real highlight of the trip, yo, you ain't gonna believe, the highlight of the trip was George Clinton.
Oh my God.
Performed in this small theater.
Wow.
With his whole show. And we got to sit there in the VIP seats and watch George Clinton. And he was amazing. 83 years old.
83.
80, sang, did all of his. I mean, George Clinton, the first time I heard him was early 60s. And I Want to Testify. I mean, way back when he had a conch. Okay. And so to hear him sing and do all this, and he had on a Kamala Harris for President t-shirt, and they just funked the house out.
Oh, that's so amazing.
I am so
happy. How long did they play?
Oh, a couple of hours. It was just, and then he did another one. Okay. Wow. This man is amazing.
He came back after?
I didn't get a chance to meet him, but I got a chance to see him, and that was good enough. And so that was one of the highlights of the trip. And again, one day we're going to talk about our trip to the Wright Museum, but we don't have time tonight. But we might get to that next week and show our pictures from that and hit some other highlights and find out who won the song contest. I know you're going to be on Pins and Needles. So, like, comment, subscribe, find us as a podcast on Spotify, on www.marshaverse and www.marshawarfield.com on YouTube. You can find us and anywhere you can stream late night shows. So if you're a late night, laid back person of a little seasoning and age, join us and spend some time with us, have some cannabis and
going. And go see Marsha at the Cellar.
And I'll be at the Cellar
all this week
until this Sunday. And then I'll keep you up to date on what I'm doing next. Got some other things in the pipeline. But I hope that you tell your friends, that you watch this show, that you leave a comment, that you tell us what you like, what you don't like, keep to yourself because we don't care. And just come back and see us again. And thanks for coming, being here tonight. Thank you, Dr. Bill. Thank you, sons.
Dr. Bill, all right.
Good night.
Can do it like that. Her own style, no one can wear that hat. Hey, don't you know that the